What I'm worried about moving forward is that Walgreens changing their policies due to political pressure is going to further the dangerous stigma.
Doctors are concerned that the removal of an abortion pill from Walgreens may impact rural Alaskans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 8th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the city of Kotzebue issues a disaster declaration as drifted snow has hampered transportation and caused other problems.
My house personally was just completely covered in snow. And you can even tell that there was a house under the snow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Pharmacy giant Walgreens is going back on a decision to offer the abortion pill mifepristone in Alaska, following pushback from the state's attorney general and 19 others nationwide. Abortion pills are still available through medical providers, but as KDOL's Riley Board reports, on the Kenai Peninsula, doctors say Walgreens' decision could create new barriers and increase stigma.
In January, the FDA approved the abortion pill mifepristone for retail in pharmacies like Walgreens, which announced shortly after that it would offer the pills in stores and by mail. There are 11 Walgreens locations in Alaska, including one in Soldotna. But now, the company is taking that back. In their letter, Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor and the other Republican attorneys general urged Walgreens not to sell the abortion pill by mail and threatened legal action. The pharmacy chain agreed yesterday to not offer the drug in Alaska or the other objecting states. Abortion is legal in Alaska, unlike several of the other states that signed on. Dr. Robin Holmes is a Homer-based family medicine physician who specializes in reproductive health care and is a fellow with Physicians for Reproductive Health. She says Alaska's landscape creates unique challenges for abortion access, and that the announcement from Walgreens could have repercussions even in communities where the company does not have stores.
Many, many remote places that may be off the road system, or even some communities on the road system, only have access to medications through the mail, and that can be provided by many of these large chains.
Holmes says despite the language of the letter, the pill is a safe and well-researched option. In 2021, it was the second most common method of abortion in Alaska. She says as it stands, Alaskans seeking the pill now have to get it through a healthcare provider at a clinic.
What this was proposing and what Walgreens has decided not to proceed with is that a prescriber could prescribe this pill and you could go to a pharmacy and pick it up just like you could any other medication, like for your diabetes or your asthma.
Holmes says going to a provider's office to get a pill can be hard in parts of Alaska with few doctors. She also worries the change sends a message about the role that politics can play in medical access in the state.
Stigma plays a big role in access to reproductive health care in this state. So what I'm worried about moving forward is that Walgreens changing their policies due to political pressure is going to further the dangerous stigma.
In their letter, the attorneys general write that they see it as their responsibility to, quote, uphold the law and protect the health, safety, and well-being of women and unborn children in our states. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Alaska legislators have urged Walgreens leadership to reconsider the decision not to sell the abortion drug mifepristone after what they called inappropriate pressure from the state attorney general, Treg Taylor. Nearly two dozen members of the state House and Senate signed on to a letter dated Monday. They enclosed a copy of the Alaska Constitution and encouraged Walgreens CEO Rosalind Taylor to review it. Representative Zach Fields, an Anchorage Democrat, said the attorney general should not be able to, quote, bully companies into undermining the constitutionally protected rights of Alaskans, end quote.
You know, our attorney general may not like the Constitution, but it is the law of the land, and he doesn't get to single-handedly eliminate core rights of Alaskans.
Abortions and the drug in question are legal in Alaska, and the state Supreme Court has ruled that the right to abortion is protected under the Alaska Constitution's Privacy Clause. In a written statement, Taylor's office said that because Walgreens did not distribute the drug directly to patients in Alaska before the letter, the availability of the drug to Alaskans has not changed. Fields said the problem is bigger than Walgreens and that other companies should know that abortions are constitutionally protected in the state of Alaska.
I've never seen another situation like that. So I think it is unprecedented. It is particularly outrageous, and it needs to be addressed immediately.
The Anchorage Daily News reported Sunday that pharmacists at other stores like Safeway, Costco, and Fred Meyer have the drug in stock or available for people with prescriptions. Alaska legislators are not the only elected officials balking at the Walgreens decision. NPR reported Tuesday that Walgreens shares fell nearly 2% after California Governor Gavin Newsom announced the state would no longer do business with the company. Kotzebue and the Northwest Arctic Borough have declared a disaster after a series of massive snowstorms in western Alaska. Kotzebue City Manager Tessa Baldwin says the city has a three-person crew working, quote, around the clock, but snow and high winds are disrupting some of the city's key operations and have left residents under a boil water notice.
Kotzebue has had storm after storm, and the most recent one, we had a power outage, which has caused a boil water notice, and an extreme amount of snow. It's been extremely hard for our first responders, emergency responders, to get to all places in the city.
The first storm hit in late February, followed by a second storm over the weekend with gusts as high as 55 miles per hour and snow in areas piled more than 20 feet high. Baldwin, a lifelong resident of Kotzebue, says these storms have been a unique situation and doesn't believe the city has experienced this much snow in decades.
We had 5 to 6 foot drifts on our main streets, and then on the back streets, we were looking at anywhere between 15 and 20 foot snow drifts. My house personally was just completely covered in snow, and you can even tell that there was a house under the snow.
In a letter to Borough Mayor Dickie Moto, Baldwin said over 70 of the city's fire hydrants were completely buried under snow. On Tuesday, Moto allocated $50,000 in disaster relief funding to hire local contractors to help with snow removal. As of this morning, the city was still asking residents to boil their drinking water. It was the second boil water notice issued within the last 2 weeks. Baldwin says the city's new water system, which began operation in November, was waiting for a part for its backup generator before the storm hit. She says Kotzebue's intermittent power outages mean that the city's water supply is losing pressure, which could cause sediments and other drainage to enter the city's drinking water. And the city's water reserves are below what Baldwin calls a comfortable level. The city has urged residents to conserve water and reduce their consumption. The heavy snow buildup is also a concern for the city, and Baldwin says flooding when the snow melts could also pose a public health crisis. Kotzebue does not have a drainage system, and she says the spring runoff could overwhelm the city's sewage system. The snow has not stopped falling. Baldwin says the Northwest Arctic is preparing for another storm to hit the region on Thursday. Meanwhile, the Environmental Protection Agency held a public hearing in Fairbanks Wednesday to gather feedback on proposed rulings on a state plan to bring an area of Fairbanks and North Pole into compliance with federal fine particulate pollution regulations. The agency is looking beyond the primary culprit of wood smoke, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, heard a mix of frustrations from the public.
The EPA has proposed disapproval of portions of the state air quality plan and ways to fix them. Agency proposals include reconsideration of new emissions controls for coal and oil-fired power plants, as well as other commercial sources of PM2.5 pollution, and a switch to cleaner-burning, more expensive, ultra-low-sulfur diesel heating fuel. The six-hour hearing included comments from dozens of people. Longtime Fairbanks resident Roger Burgraff took aim at the proposed ultra-low-sulfur diesel requirement.
There is no refinery in interior Alaska that produces low-rank sulfur fuel. And the cost of making everybody comply with it will be astronomical.
Shane Coyley, senior vice president of Doyon Utilities, which operates Fort Wainwright's coal-fired power plant, was also critical of the EPA regulatory proposals.
Proposed solutions will do very little to improve the local air quality, but continue to drive local residents out of Fairbanks due to the increased cost of living here. We need the EPA to address the real causes, and the community can direct its resources to the correct solutions.
Others like Philip White acknowledged the cost of cleaning up the air, but weighed it against the health impacts of air pollution.
So I am worried about higher energy costs for my fellow residents. I'm also worried about the high costs that our elected leaders too often ignore. The stunted brain development of our children, the costs of dialysis and cancer treatment, the higher rates of dementia in our elders. So I urge the EPA to recognize these enormous externalities. And, you know, overall here, I would urge the EPA to be fair, but firm, to recognize the kind of unique environment up here, but get us on a plan that is going to redress this problem and ensure that, you know, we can breathe healthy air here.
Andrea Feniger also highlighted health impacts and laid blame on state regulators.
Too many Alaskans have already paid for our state's negligence with their health and with their lives, and robust enforcement cannot be delayed any longer.
Patrice Lee with Citizens for Clean Air offered several proposals to help reduce fine particulate pollution without putting a financial burden on local people.
Subsidize the cost of electricity on bad air days during alerts. Subsidize the cost difference between number 2 or 1 and the ULSD. Allow heat pumps to be covered under the targeted airshed grant without destruction of the former boiler or wood stove that would become the backup. Place the non-attainment area in the power cost equalization plan or create a similar plan.
Lee also advocated for support of renewable energy projects and state sale of some of its royalty natural gas to the Interior Gas Utility. The deadline to comment on the EPA's proposed air quality plan actions is March 22nd. The agency must issue a final ruling on the state implementation plan by the end of the year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, I did a rookies get a taste of life out on the trail.
The other runs were all crazy, you know, because you're coming down mountains and, you know, but that was like, holy smokes. This just seems like the definition of insanity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
The Alaska legislature has voted unanimously to block raises for the state's governor, lieutenant governor, and the commissioners in charge of state departments, the Alaska Beacon reports. The state house voted 40-0 Monday evening to approve Senate Bill 86, which blocks the raises from coming into effect. The Senate approved the bill 19-0 on February 27th. Once transmitted to Governor Mike Dunleavy, the governor will have until March 23rd to sign the bill, veto it, or allow it to become law without his signature. The bill was introduced by members of the state Senate after the State Officers' Compensation Commission, charged by law with setting the salaries of the state's top elected and non-elected officials, proposed raises for the top members of the executive branch. Those raises were intended to represent adjustments for inflation, but leading legislators suggested the raises were inappropriate and introduced legislation to block them. The Compensation Commission failed to suggest changes to legislative pay, suggesting further analysis is needed. In addition, the Alaska Department of Administration has proposed a statewide analysis of all state salaries. Meanwhile, the federal government is walking back a proposal that would have allowed brown bear baiting and reversed other restrictions on hunting and trapping in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. As KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports, it's one of two decisions in the last week that environmental groups say is a win for the refuge and its wildlife.
As it stands, the practice of taking brown bears at bait stations is not allowed on the 2-million-acre refuge, thanks to an Obama-era regulation known as the Kenai Rule. In 2020, the Trump administration tried to reverse those protections in a proposed new rule, which also would have opened up access in the refuge to more bicycles and snow machines. But those rules never passed. And on Friday, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced it was withdrawing the proposal, citing the tens of thousands of comments submitted in opposition to the change over concerns about impacts to wildlife and visitor safety. The withdrawal isn't the only victory for those commenters. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up a legal challenge to the rule from the state of Alaska and Safari Club International, which has been working its way through the court for several years.
This week was a big week in terms of the movement on these protections.
Nicole Schmidt is executive director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, which has been defending the original rule and its protections. She says the decision shows the federal government does have authority to manage wildlife on refuge lands, including for the purpose of maintaining natural diversity.
The second big point is that through the decision to rescind the 2020 rule, I think the refuge really listened to and took a hard look at what those changes would really mean on the ground.
In its decision, Fish and Wildlife cited concerns about public safety related to brown bear baiting and increased access for hunters, for example. But advocates of the 2020 rule have a different take. Alaska has long argued it has the authority to manage wildlife on federal lands within the state, and it says brown bear baiting does not pose a risk to public safety. Ben Cassidy with Safari Club International said in a written statement, quote, "Wildlife management decisions should not be made based on the number of public comments, but on the best available science. And the best available science supported the proposed rule," end quote. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Anchorage Assembly has permanently enacted city code changes in an effort to rein in spending by Mayor Dave Bronson's administration. A new ordinance lowers the dollar amount in contracts that would require assembly approval, continuing a process approved in an emergency ordinance earlier this year. The move from the assembly comes months after former municipal manager Amy Demboski, who was abruptly fired by Bronson in December, accused the mayor's administration of issuing contracts and approving work on expensive projects without assembly approval. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant alluded to Bronson approving millions of dollars of work on a failed homeless navigation center in his support for the code changes.
This is an important part in the efforts to bring compliance by this administration by shortening the leash within which they are allowed to act freely.
The ordinance lowers the threshold for competitive contracts requiring assembly approval from $500,000 to $150,000 and requires assembly approval for changes to contracts initially larger than $50,000. Bronson spoke in opposition to the ordinance, which he described as microscopic management. He says since the assembly first passed the emergency ordinance in January, the city's purchasing department has been overworked.
That includes 32 purchasing officers in the various departments and the entire purchasing department, to the point where I've had employees approach me from the purchasing department with over 20 years of experience saying they're looking at quitting because of these emergency orders.
The ordinance passed 9-1 with member Randy Salt opposed. Meanwhile, the Anchorage Assembly unanimously approved a parental leave policy for executive and non-union city employees in its meeting yesterday. It mirrors a policy enacted by then-acting Mayor Austin Quinn Davidson in June 2021. Mayor Bronson rescinded the policy after he took office the next month. Quinn Davidson, who currently represents West Anchorage on the Assembly, brought forward the new ordinance with members Meg Zalatel and Suzanne LaFrance. The policy would allow employees to receive 4 weeks of paid leave after the birth of a child or an adoption or foster care placement. Quinn Davidson says she's excited for the policy.
Paid parental leave is pro-family and pro-business. It comes with many, many benefits.
Quinn Davidson cited studies on the benefits of paid parental leave, which showed decreases in infant mortality and more opportunities for parents to bond with their children. She also noted that it would make the city a more competitive employer. The Assembly can only make benefit changes to non-union represented employees. Quinn Davidson made an amendment to the ordinance to urge the mayor to help negotiate the benefit for union employees, who she says make up more than three-quarters of the city workforce.
We're hoping that the mayor, if this policy does pass, which I really hope it will, that he'll then work, he and his team, with the bargaining units of those unions to add this benefit.
In a statement, Bronson said he supports the policy, writing, quote, "I look forward to having discussions with the unions on how we best can craft a path forward that works for represented employees and the city."
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Most Iditarod teams settled into their mandatory 24-hour breaks today, many resting in McGrath and Takotna. Jesse Holmes, Brent Sass, and Aaron Peck are further up the trail resting in Ophir, while Wade Mars leads the Iditarod out of that checkpoint. But in the way back of the pack, things feel a lot different. Greg Vitello was the last musher into Nikolai this morning. As Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, the Iditarod rookie is having one heck of a ride.
As he does his final chores before departing the Nikolai Dockyard, 47-year-old Greg Vitello has a lot on his mind. For one, he's not looking forward to pushing through this drizzle.
I think it's pretty miserable. I'm soaking already. It gets pretty dangerous if it gets really cold tonight, too.
He's worried about his clothes getting even more wet in the rain and then freezing at night. It's only the latest challenge confronting the New Hampshire musher running his first Iditarod. He says it's everything he expected, but more and harder, like the moguls along the trail. After a nap inside the school, he calls that 40-mile stretch of bumps ridiculous.
The other runs were all crazy, you know, because you're coming down mountains and, you know, but that was like, holy smokes. This just seems like the definition of insanity.
The steep and windy Dalzell Gorge was no cakewalk either. He says his leader, also named Greg, saved his life by pulling him away from a steep precipice. He soaked his boots going through water in the treeless farewell burn area and was forced to camp out on trail in his wet gear. On top of that, the 30-minute snooze he got in Nikolai was all the sleep he's had since the race started on Sunday. Still, he said 90% of the time he's having a blast on his first Iditarod experience.
But even when I was almost dying out there, I was like, I'm still having the time of my life.
Plus, he got an unexpected gift for coming into Nikolai in last place.
Really great of the people here, and made a handmade beautiful beaver hat for the last person to this checkpoint.
Vitello's son, Bailey, is also running this year's race. The younger Vitello is miles ahead. Greg Vitello says the two overlapped briefly at the start of the race, but since then, they've been running alone. He's not worried about Bailey.
In the woods, I'm not worried about Bailey. If you dropped him off in the city, I might, but...
And he says, for now, Bailey doesn't have to be worried about him. Reporting in Nikolai, I'm Lex Trinan.
The World War II-era tugboat that sank in Juneau last December has finally been hauled away after nearly 2 months underwater. The wooden tug cost more than $500,000 to recover, and the vessel is a symptom of a larger problem. As Alaska's fleet ages, harbormasters, boat owners, and the state face a costly environmental hazard. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
An 81-year-old tugboat called the Tagish met its watery end when a cold snap cracked its pipes. Its sinking ended a decades-long restoration project for Juneau local Don Etheridge.
I had most of the deck rebuilt. I rebuilt the entire interior of it, and it scares me to think about how much I'd put into it.
The remains of the boat and the pollution it released were recovered by the Coast Guard and shipped off to a landfill in Seattle. Cleanup costs reached $650,000, a cost Etheridge could not cover up front. It's hard to restore old vessels to their former glory, but it can be even harder and more expensive to dispose of them.
It costs you a small fortune to get rid of a boat. It's cheaper to pay your mortgage than it is to get rid of the boat.
So the Tagish floated for decades as Etheridge worked little by little to restore it. For many years, he even had it insured.
And then the insurance company notified me that they weren't going to insure it no more. The age of the boat being as old as it is and being a wood boat.
Just like that, a hobby project became a huge liability. In Alaska and many other coastal states, boats are aging. According to the McKinley Research Group in Anchorage, more than half the vessels in Southeast Alaska are beyond the typical lifespan for boats.
So the Tagish is it's a symptom of a bigger problem. We're in Alaska. We're remote. Boats are getting older. There is not an easy, cost-effective way to dispose of vessels when they reach the end of their useful life.
That's Matt Cresswell, Juneau's harbor master. Old boats have caused multiple headaches in the community over the last decade. But until 2018, the state did not require ownership titles on boats, which made it nearly impossible to hold someone accountable for cleanup costs. Rachel Lord is the former executive secretary for the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators. She helped pass legislation that required vessel titles and expanded the state's abandoned and derelict vessels program. But she says the law doesn't do enough to address the aging fleet.
These large old boats are liabilities. They're beautiful. They were part of our history. In some cases, they're still part of our working fleets. And they all have a lifetime, a clock that is ticking. And so the question really becomes, who bears that liability? Who bears that cost?
In this case, it's still Etheridge. But a bill of more than $500,000 is a significant burden for many private boat owners. When a boat poses a pollution threat that owners can't afford to clean up, the Coast Guard may be called in to dispose of it using money from the Federal Oil Spill Liability Fund. That's what happened with the Tagish.
And theoretically, you know, owners are kept accountable. But also, you know, that is not an unending pool of money that the Coast Guard is just going to be authorized to continue using ad nauseum to deal with all of our vessels.
The federal government might set up payment plans to work with vessel owners. But Coast Guard officials confirmed that their costs for vessel cleanup are often not fully recouped. Technically, federal funds are the last resort. But because vessel disposal is so expensive, that's often what it comes to. Vessels sink, and then federal funding starts to flow. Other coastal states, like Washington, have developed programs to get ahead of the issue. The state has a pool of money to reimburse municipalities for vessel cleanup and a voluntary vessel turn-in program for boat owners.
You're dealing with it proactively instead of having to deal with sunken vessels and mitigation and cleanup and all the other things that happen when a vessel starts coming apart.
Alaska has an abandoned and derelict vessels program, but that program has no state funding. According to attorney Holly Wells, who helped to write the state law, there's a lot of gray area when it comes to long-term restoration projects like the Tagish. It can be tricky to declare a boat derelict. The burden of proof falls on the state or municipality. Neither has the money to examine aging vessels. And old boats are essentially uninsurable. Juneau Docks and Harbors are discussing ways to prevent another situation like the Tagish. But they don't have a robust funding structure to deal with vessel cleanup. And Wells says it's really the state that should be taking the lead.
And the more we can do that on a state level, the better, because when municipalities are bearing the burden of adopting restrictive laws or imposing insurance provisions, that impacts their relationship with the users of their harbor and their facilities. On the local level, that can be really damning.
In Alaska, the Abandoned and Derelict Vessels Program lacks teeth and state funding, which leaves a floating liability across the state's coastline. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Riley Board and Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Claire Strempel and Anna Canny in Juneau, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lex Trinan in Nikolai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.